Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2025 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2024, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a staggering $150,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial festivals and online programs. Imagining the Past is commercial-free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation, and we can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website, www.hnsa.org.au. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. Jane Harrison's novel, The Visitors, won the debut novel at the Indie Book Awards in 2024 and was longlisted for the 2024 ARA Historical Novel Prize. Apart from the uniqueness of the story, the whole project had a most unusual genesis. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jane Harrison to Imagining the Past.
Thank you for having me, Greg.
When did you first start to think about being a writer and writing?
Ah, that's a good question. I'd always worked in creative areas. So I studied industrial design at college and had a very sideways career path in publishing and advertising. And I guess in advertising, that's when my love of writing, I was a copywriter, became to come to the fore. But I lost my job in advertising and I saw a small ad in the paper for a writer researcher wanted for production of The Lost Children, an Aboriginal sort of story about the stolen generations. And so I applied for that and I was selected, and that was my first play, Stolen. So after that, I figured I was a writer.
Wow, that's an interesting story with writing advertising copy. I thought that would have been the easiest way to kill off a writer.
Well, there's been a few copywriters. Bryce Courtney was a copywriter. Peter Carey was a copywriter. So a few people have made the transition.
And it's a very succinct use of language too, I'm sure. So it must make you consider every syllable, really.
Well, you get paid to be creative. And so that's the incentive, I think.
So why did you choose to start writing for theatre? How many new playwrights actually get published and how many plays get staged? It seems such a huge project to stage a play.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I responded to that ad for the production of The Lost Children. That became the play Stolen, but that took 6 years to get staged. Eventually, the Malthouse Theatre, or Playbox as it was then, staged it. And so, I hadn't even been to a lot of theatre before that. So I was really raw and really new to theatre, writing for theatre. But I learned as I went along. And as I said, then I thought, well, I've had my first play produced in 1998. I must be a playwright. So I started, my second play and then my third play. The second play never went anywhere. It was, I put a lot of research into it, but it was a overwrought second play. So my third play was Rainbow's End, and then that ended up being staged by Ilbijiri Theatre Company as well.
So what was the first ideas you had around The Visitors? How did that come about?
Yeah, that was a play idea first. And it was kind of that a few things came together. One was the Northern Territory intervention, which happened way back in 2007. Everyone's probably forgotten about that now. But I remember a colleague saying to me, now when I walk down the street, people will think I'm a pedophile as an Aboriginal man, because there was so much, discussion and media attention about remote communities and sexual abuse. You know, they sent the army into Aboriginal communities. And so I thought, that doesn't represent the Aboriginal men I know, who are family men, who are good providers, who are, you know, funny, who are clever, resourceful. So I thought I wanted to write a play about Aboriginal men, even though I'm a woman, so it could be considered men's business, but I wanted to write about the men. And I had just seen the play 12 Angry Men. And so I thought, I will take that plot line and I will write my own version of that. And I tried to get permission to do a new adaptation of 12 Angry Men, but they wouldn't give me permission. So I knew then that I could still use the thread of that idea of the sort of courtroom drama, but I had to make it my own. So I did that over a period of time, and it had a number of workshops. And eventually Mogollon Theatre Company up in Sydney decided to stage it.
What year was that?
2020, as part of Sydney Festival. So it had a short season there, but it was sold out and had an extra performance put on, and it was a hit. But then COVID happened, and so the play could not tour or be restaged. And so it's...
None of us could tour.
So you
haven't quite explained, though, how you arrived at the idea of The Visitors, you know, because it's quite a unique idea. Where did that come from?
Yeah, well, it was, like I said, I wanted to write about Aboriginal men. And so the 12 Angry Men kind of gave me a plot where I could have those characters together. And then the other thing that inspired me was the thought that there had never been anything written from the first people's perspective of the arrival of the First Fleet. And so I wanted to tell that story, but it's just before the arrival of the fleet, like as they're arriving. So it's kind of like the end of innocence, really, for those characters.
And where did the idea come after you'd had it staged as a play? How did you come about then to think to write it as a novel?
Yes, well, I'd had the 2020 season, very short season, and then, of course, COVID had happened. And it was during those COVID years that I thought, well, maybe I can write it as a book. In fact, I think before it was staged, I'd had the idea to write it as a book, because at that stage, people weren't interested in plays about men either. It was a kind of a feminist wave around theatre, and women directors were getting opportunities, and female-centred plays were all the rage. And so I didn't think anyone would want to put on a play with seven Aboriginal men, as it was in those days. Of course, in more recent versions of the play, there's now female performers playing some of those roles. But back in 2020, it was all male. So I thought, I'll have more chance to get the play published than I will, the story published, than I will to get it performed. And so I started writing that version. I had to do a lot more research, but I sent 5,000 words off to an agent, and then they sold it on to HarperCollins, and I got a contract to write the rest.
So it's actually your first novel? It's the first time you had tried to write a novel?
I've written a YA novel in the past, Becoming Kiralee Lewis, and that was published by Magabala. That was back in 2014.
So how different was it writing, you know, a play and a novel? And was it almost like you were translating one form to the other, or do you see them as completely separate?
I don't see them as completely separate because I used a lot of the dialogue in the play as dialogue in the book, but it was a different experience. I mean, in theatre, you can't write description, you know, that would be considered didactic. So, well, in a book, you can describe something. You can describe the setting, you can describe the inner thinkings of the characters. And so it gave me a lot more freedom, but I had to do a lot more research. And so a lot of that time spent writing the novel, I think it was in 2022, was spent researching it, you know, researching the plants and animals. I even found a book by a naturalist in Sydney on cicadas, the 24 species of the Sydney cicadas. So I used some of the detail from that book in The Visitors. And so, yeah, I did it. I walked country. I went on trips up to Sydney and took the ferry to Parramatta to kind of mirror the journey that Walter would have taken in his canoe. And I walked on country as well and, you know, just tried to absorb as much as I could.
So were there any actually written first reports of that you were able to use, anything that you found in the archive that you were able to use?
Not from the First Nations perspective. I mean, the first letter written in English was by Bennelong, and I think that was in, 1800s, early 1800s. And that's the first known example of anything written in English. So, but I did use the transcripts of the First Fleet. I delved into those, and I've got about a meter of historical books on the Sydney region and First Contact that I delved into.
So was it, I would imagine when you don't have written accounts of what you want specifically, that you have to read what you have and kind of almost work on the other side of the coin, or just try and imagine the other side of the coin, almost imagine into the cracks of what you have.
Yeah, exactly. It's a reimagining. So that's what I did. I sort of based the characters on Aboriginal people that I knew in contemporary times. And some people have said that the book is very much like a land council meeting or something that they've attended, you know, that idea of you get people around in the space having a conversation, trying to come up with an agreement about something, and all the different points of view, even though they're all Aboriginal people, they have various points of view and come from different perspectives.
Well, so, yeah, that's clear in the novel, that the people who arrive, the seven men who arrive at the meeting, are almost purposely from different country and different, so therefore different cultures, which I thought was really nicely teased out, because when we speak of any group, we tend to homogenize the whole group together, no matter how big it is. Like you
exactly.
speak of Italians, and we've got, you know, certain things that we think of. So I thought that was very well done in the novel.
Yeah. And, you know, like the people I know, they're all different, you know. They have different perspectives and different lived experiences that they bring to the, you know, I wanted to humanize them.
So for someone who had seen the play, what do you think is new or different about the novel?
Yeah, I think the novel goes deeper into their lives, and it's almost like country is another character in the book. I think the kind of descriptions of country and the wildlife, and, you know, the animals and the birds and trees and the medicinal plants. I think that someone once described the book as being like a walk with an elder, which I found really You know, I was really pleased with that description because I think you can learn a lot about the country by reading the book.
Yeah, it does have a lot of just facts, really. Like, there's a lot of facts in it about how people lived and how they viewed the country.
Yes, but very, still much character base. So they had to be relevant to the characters, like, Nathaniel being the canoe maker, describing how to build a canoe. So, you know, I didn't want it just to be exposition. It had to be relevant to that particular character where he made banana.
You've kind of mentioned this a little bit, but it feels like some of the conventions of writing a play did come over into the novel. Like, for example, the novel's written in present tense, which almost is like a convention of the stage directions in a play or in present tense. But you've also delineated the speech acts seem to almost be like they're written almost like they are in a script. So do you think there were other hangovers from the play that you brought over into the book?
Not really. I think they're the most noticeable traits from the play to the book is the way I structured the dialogue and also that present tense. The present tense was to make it, I didn't want it to seem, you know, stuck in a particular time and place. I mean, I did mess with people's heads a little bit by having the characters wear Western style dress in the book and as I did in the play. And I had a lot of discussion with my publisher about that. She was not so sure about having them wear Western clothes, but I wanted to pay homage to the idea of time in the Aboriginal point of view being the past, present and the future coexisting at once. So I wanted it to be relevant to, you know, 2025 as well as 1788.
Because you also use the characters have Western names and a lot of their language is incredibly modern. So I'm just kind of wondering a bit more about your choices about doing those and what you kind of thought the result of that was.
Yeah, I didn't want my characters to be the noble savage. So particularly on the stage, if you had them naked or near naked, we would have othered them. We wouldn't have recognized them as, you know, equal to us. So I thought of them, to me, they were the statesmen of that era. They were the, senators. And so I wanted to put them in suits and have them be people that you would recognize today. And so, yeah, that was my idea to sort of, I didn't want them to be noble savages. I wanted them recognizable people.
That's interesting because other First Nations writing I've read and also interviewed, I've suggested that sometimes their characterizations do kind of start to border on the noble savage in that these people are completely in harmony with nature, completely in harmony with one another. And it just seems to be pushed a little bit too far sometimes.
Yes, I probably, I want to shy away from that. I want to humanize Aboriginal people. I don't want them to be othered. So I think if you're too romantic about people, then it's you don't recognize them as being your equal. So, yeah, I wanted to make my characters real. They've got foibles, they've got faults, they've got flaws. And they don't always get along with one another. There's conflict as well that happens. And, yeah, I just wanted to avoid that kind of romanticising of Aboriginal culture and that everything was in harmony. I mean, we're not in harmony today. We have people with different points of view and conflict within the community.
Absolutely. So I'm just wondering if you could tell us a bit about how you deployed point of view in the novel and how that kind of differs from how you would have done it in the play. I had a think for a while about how is point of view used in a play, and it took me a while to, you know, arrive at something like Hamlet is definitely told from Hamlet's point of view. So I'm just wondering how you deployed it in the play and how you changed that to deploy it in the novel.
So I guess the basic difference with the novel is that, you know, I've gone much deeper into their lives before the meeting. So I've set them each up with their own chapter, and we see them coming to the point where they are invited to the meeting. And so we get to see them on their home turf a little bit more and see, again, the diversity of their different countries and their ways of life. And so I think, you know, it's unusual in a novel to have seven protagonists. I mean, I have noticed that I write collective stories. I don't write from a single protagonist point of view. And I think that's my Aboriginal heritage is sort of, you know, makes me prefer to write collective stories. And so there's seven points of view in the novel and in the play as well. And in the play, they all get their own monologues. They all get their moment in the spotlight to talk about the reasoning. You know, we haven't talked about the basic idea of the story, which is their response to the arrival of the First Fleet and what they're going to do about it, whether they're going to send them on their way or allow them to land. And they have to come up with a unanimous decision about that. And so, I think just their point of view, you know, they're allowed to have their moments of individualization in the story. And, you know, we see the other characters in their lives as well, their family members and things early on in the early chapters of the book. I hope that answers that question.
I mean, you've definitely, as you've said today, with a novel, you can actually go into someone's head, whereas in a play, the best you can offer up is a soliloquy kind of thing, which is a very forced kind of mechanism to the internal machinations of someone's head. But like, I wonder too, with having the seven protagonists, that's a lot of players, you know, to have a lot of balls to have in the air at the one time. And I wonder, was there any difficulty? Did you have problems with keeping everyone moving and everything kind of together?
Yes, there's a lot of, I call it the choreography of the play and of the story, in that there's a lot of movement of the characters towards one another and repelling one another. And so you can do that easily in a play because you can physically have people in the room moving towards one another and away from one another and aligning with one another and agreeing and disagreeing, and those moments of conflict. And of course, in the book, I had to kind of show that a little bit more, or tell that a little bit more. Like in a play, it's show, don't tell, but in a book, can tell a little bit more. So yeah, it was a lot. And I solved that dilemma of having the seven different characters by, I cast them in my mind with actors that I knew. And so I could then write to that particular character, like Uncle Joseph was based on Uncle Jack Charles, who was a beloved, you know, theatre figure down in Melbourne. And so once I had kind of cast him in my mind, I was able to write around that character's, you know, personality and character.
Other Indigenous writers I've interviewed have kind of always suggested that it's impossible to write a pre-colonial story. I mean, yours is literally down to the last few minutes. So I'm just wondering how you feel about, you know, can a story of 100 years before the arrival of Europeans, can that be written?
Well, I think the film Ten Canoes tried to do that as well. And You know, I see it very much as this play and this story, this book is very much about that innocence before the corrupting influence of colonization happens. And so, you know, again, they're not perfect and it's not a utopia. They have their differences. They have conflicts within their communities. We see that in the story. But, you know, I do see them as, you know, being able to live quite in harmony with their environment. And, yeah, so I think you can write that story. But, you know, there's not a lot of research that you can do about it. So you have to use your imaginations.
There's a novel recently released, A Piece of Red Cloth by Leonie Norrington, which unfortunately I haven't read at this point, but that does seem to have overcome some of these problems of the research and the factual things. It seems another step towards this pre-colonial kind of novel.
Yes. Yeah, and of course in the book I go a little bit further than the play and I talk about the 18 months that happened after the arrival. And so I avoided that in the play. I wanted the play to end on a kind of optimistic note that all agreed because they were, you know, convinced that their cultural protocols would kind of protect them. And that they had always welcomed strangers to country as long as people obeyed the laws of country. But then in the book I talk about what happened afterwards and I talk about things like the smallpox epidemic and everything like that. So it's not quite as optimistic book as the play.
As we've discussed today, the whole project of The Visitors, the play and the novel, it's a fairly long kind of gestation period that you had. Writers now are often, you know, asked to produce a novel every year or two. I just wonder what you think the longer period of developing this novel and in the different formats, what do you think that brought to the novel that may not have happened if you just sat down to write the novel?
Yeah, I don't know. I a lot of my major projects like Stolen took 6 years and The Visitors took, you know, something like 11 years from first thinking of the idea to its final iterations. And there was also the opera. I did an opera of The Visitors here in Victoria.
Oh,
so
wow.
Iteration. I was co-writing these things all through 2022. I think the longer period allows me to just go deeper into the research. I don't have a really great memory, so I'm not like a historian who can reel off facts and figures and give you the minutiae of those historical kind of things that happened. But I kind of think my head is like a blender. It all goes in and then out comes a smoothie. Hopefully it doesn't have big chunks of fiber and whatever else. So I think that longer period allows me to do that, to, you know, have all those ideas coalesce into one narrative. Yeah. I mean, I can write quickly if I have to, but I do prefer the longer period of time and other things at the same time. So, you know, life has a way of impacting on art.
In the last few paragraphs of the novel, the we pronoun kind of erupts into the narrative. There's something incredibly poignant and beautiful about this. I'm just wondering what your thinking was around that, for it's almost like you are now in the novel.
Yes. Again, that was a deliberate choice that I made because I kind of felt that it was a a call to action, really. In a way, the play was a call to action, and it happened to coincide with the voice referendum. And in fact, the last performance of the play at Sydney Opera House was on the night of the referendum, and the cast chose not to know what that outcome was before they went on stage. But I think in the novel, it was a really call to action for people to understand both the significance of January 26 and what it means to Aboriginal people, and just to recognise the sort of the devastation of colonisation for Aboriginal people, and that we collectively, it's still in our bodies. That effect of the colonisation is still, you know, it's still in our lives, and it affects deaths in custody. It affects, you know, incarceration, you know, how people react to the health service, how people interact with schools and education systems and systems in general. And so, yeah, I just wanted to kind of, it's a bit of a slap in the face, really. I think the rest of the book is quite gentle and at times hopefully funny, but that last chapter is really, you know, where I'm laying down, you know, just the consequences of colonization.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know that I read it as a slap. I think I felt quite kind of embalmed in it, or taken into the we in a way. Like it, I felt it was a much broader, you know, we. Like, I mean, English only has one word for we. We don't have one that includes one group and not another group, which some other languages do. But yeah, I didn't read it as a slap. I felt like I was part of this story. It kind of took me into the story or something.
Oh, great. Well, that's good.
What are you working on now? What's happening now?
What, three plays on the go?
Oh. There's only 24 hours in a day, you know.
And I've got a young adult novel, which is a follow-up to my Kiralee story, but set 20 years later with the same characters.
Who are now not young adults.
Who are now not young adults, but Kiralee is in fact the parent of a young adult. So I'm working on that, and I will have a play with Sydney Theatre Company next year.
Oh, lovely. Wow.
So, and that came out of writing the Visitors play, because I became very interested in the character of Bennelong as being a pivotal man in those early days of the colony who sort of had a foot in both camps. And so, and of course, he went to London and was taken over there for nearly 3 years and fated over there.
It's an interesting story, isn't it? It's hard to imagine someone being taken, you know, around the world and back. It's kind of...
Yes. Yeah. And what he chose to do after he returned, he kind of rejected the Western ways, and went back to the mob and lived there for another 30 years.
So you were long listed for the 2024 ARA Historical Novel Prize. I'm just wondering, how was that? How did that feel, and what's the result of that for you?
Yeah, I mean, that was a great honour. And, you know, because it has those contemporary touches throughout the book as well, it's interesting that it's deemed a historical novel because, you know, got the contemporary clothes and the language and the like. But yeah, no, I was thrilled. So very happy for it to be long listed.
And this year you're judging the prize. I'm just wondering how that experience has been for you, obviously without being specific. Has it made a novel? Or, I mean, you can't talk about a novel specifically at this point, but I'm just wondering what it's been like to be on the other side of the coin in judging it.
Yes. Well, it's a lot of reading. Huge amount of reading, and I'm glad I'm semi-retired to enable me to just delve into the books. I get quite caught up in the books, and I like to know where the narrative arc of the book is. So I, read to the end, most of them, and the breadth of the subject matter in a historical novel is quite astounding. I mean, there's of course First Fleet stories, there's World War II stories, World War I stories, but just the, sheer scope of them, stories based on real historical figures, made up stories, crime, murder in the outback, the whole gamut, religious stories. I'm just, amazed. So I haven't read so widely in such a long time. So,
and they're all written, even though a lot of these stories are not set in Australia, they're all written by Australians or New Zealanders.
Yeah.
So it's a lovely, it's a lovely window to look through writing through.
Fascinating. I've learned so much. Stories set in Russia, the North Passages of the Arctic, the breadth is astounding.
Well, thank you for your time today. I've enjoyed our chat with, and I enjoyed your novel. It was really insightful to read. Like, I enjoyed it.
I'm so glad. I'm so pleased to hear that. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2025 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find a wealth of interviews. And it's festival year, History Unbound, to be held at Parramatta Town Hall on the 1st and 2nd of November 2025. Both in-person and online tickets are available. Please visit our website www.hnsa.org.au, register for our newsletter, and join our social media groups to be up to date. I'm Greg Johnston. Keep reading, keep listening, and keep imagining the past. Imagining the Past is commercial free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation, and we can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website, www.hnsa.org.au. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated.